at the end of Normal Street, 2500 Estes Road. Doors are at 6, show at 7. Max Gomez will be opening the show from 7 to 7:45. So your KZFR benefit, tickets are $25, available at the door. Parking is free and included. Please carpool or ride your bike. Do not park on Estes Road. Outside the venue, you will be towed. There'll be food available from Wonder Food Truck and beverages from Sierra Nevada. No dogs, kids under 12 free, blankets and lawn chairs welcome. And come on down. James should hit the stage at about 8 o'clock.
I went to the doctor and the doctor said, son, you look older than me, and I'm 71. You're falling apart, you're not living right. I went to the doctor and the doctor said loud, you got to stop hanging out with that old in crowd. Living's a battle, yeah, and you're losing the fight. I went to the doctor and the doctor said, boy, your body is a temple, it's not a toy. Fill up this here paper cup and give it to the nurse. Don't spill it now. I went to the doctor.
Hello, this is Ken Logan and the Doctor's Inn. I'm a family practice doctor here in Chico, and I do this show, The Doctor's Inn, to discuss health and medical-related issues that I hope are of interest to you. If you have any subjects you would like me to include on this show, you could email me at klogan.md@yahoo.com. The opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by the generous contributions of you, the KZFR supporters, and by Friends of the Arts, a state local partner to the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity through arts and culture by producing community festival and events, including Artoberfest, Chico Paleo, the True North Tour, the Silent Film Festival, the NorCal Jazz Festival, the Salmon Festival, and more. To learn about Friends of the Arts, visit friendsoftheartsupstate.org. And by Bigfoot Carpet, providing professional installation of carpet, tile, vinyl, laminate, and hardwood flooring for the greater Chico area. Bigfoot Carpet carries a large in-stock selection, and is located at 3436 Highway 32 in Suite 100. Bigfoot Carpets can be reached by calling 879-000. I'm not sure if that's correct. Or by visiting BigfootCarpets.com. So that's BigfootCarpets.com. Well, today's show is going to be interesting. It's about anthropology. Anthropology as it relates to human health and disease of today. Here to discuss this subject and share her knowledge and ideas with us is Melody Yeager, lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at our very own CSU Chico and at Butte College. Melody Yeager, thank you for being here. Hello.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks. So tell us about anthropology. Tell us about how the human being as we are today. How did we get where we are today, anthropologically?
How much time do we have?
Yeah.
So when we're looking at anthropology, we're studying humans, and we break it up within our field into a few different areas, because to just say we're studying humans is a really, it's a big field. So we break it up into the physical side, where we look at the human body, and then we also break it up into the cultural side. So we study how we have changed over time culturally, look at our current cultural trends, how the environment influences culture, and how culture influences the environment. So in my area, I do mostly cultural, but that inevitably, of course, includes physical because we have to look at how our bodies have changed throughout time. Now, how did we get to where we are today? That's a question that we answer through archaeology, which is also a subfield of anthropology, and paleoanthropology. So peeling back the layers of the earth, so to speak, and having specialists who know the body and who know the evolutionary bodies of our ancestors, and trying to kind of figure out where they belong on, we'll go ahead and call the family tree, right? So when we look back at that, I kind of use Homo erectus, who I'm sure most of our listeners who have at least heard of. Homo erectus is the first of our ancestors to have a really rapid growth in brain size. And that is one of the hallmarks of what it means to be human. When we talk about what it means to be human, we have a couple of things. You know, we walk upright, we're bipeds. We're the only bipeds who walk the way we do on the planet. And someone's going, what about flamingos and penguins? But we're the only ones who do this type of locomotion that we do. We also have the largest brain to body size ratio of any animal on the planet. So how did we get here? You know, how come chimpanzees, who we haven't had a similar relationship with for 18 million years, why isn't their brain growing at a steady rate like ours has? So these are the kinds of answers that we're really trying to get to. And I should also say the most important, most exciting thing for me about anthropology is we don't have all the answers yet. I love that. I love that science is still kind of unraveling in front of us as we increase our knowledge base and our technologies. So how did we get where we are? We had quite a few different ancestors who lived in Africa exclusively until about 1.8 to 1.6 million years ago. A lot of people have trouble wrapping their brain around time. And I'm one of those people, you know, and I have to see it physically.
Especially that many years.
That many years.
I mean, that's a ridiculous number.
It is. Yeah, I mean, if you looked at, if you turned the entire history of the earth into a football field, right? It would be about the width of a pencil lead that humans and our ancestors have even been on the planet. You know, so if that helps some of our more visual listeners, you know, it helps me certainly. So when we look at 1.8 million years, you know, we're talking about that width of the pencil lead included. So when we go back that far, but that is also a very long time, you know, and then if we put it in the scope of who we are today, you know, our ancestors, the European North Americans, have only been here in North America for 500 years or so. You know, so very small amount of time. So about 1.8 million years ago, 1.6 million years ago, the very first upright walker left Africa. So that's kind of that connection that I make. The brain started really growing in size, and they moved out of Africa and started populating Europe and Western Asia, and then down even into Southeast Asia, which is interesting as well. And they were really kind of the seeds of these future, you know, descendants to come along who are our ancestors still. Some of the important things to know about them, one of the things that a lot of anthropologists talk about when we do talk about brain size is, where did we get all the energy, you know, to grow this brain? The brain is a really hungry organ. We use about 20% of our metabolic energy just to power our brain.
Say that one more time.
20% of our resting metabolic energy to power our brain. That's a lot. You know, it's a huge investment just for this organ that we use, you know. And so for so many of our ancestors to be very content exactly where they were, you know, they never got up and moved. To me, there's kind of this spark that happened, or had to have happened, with Homo erectus to leave comfort. To branch out, to leave really tropical, warm northeastern Africa and to move into glacial Europe. You know, why? What would be the motivating factor there? And to me, it seems like curiosity and some of these kind of newer areas of the brain. So how did we grow our brain? Richard Wrangham, who I'm a big fan of, he's a Harvard professor. He wrote a great book called Catching Fire that predated the newest series of Catching Fire that most people know about. And he looks at how fire changed human evolution. So now we can start talking about the control of fire, right? And there is evidence, not really, really clear evidence, but there's evidence that Homo erectus was at least cooking some of the foods. So what does cooking do? You know, it breaks down food, almost pre-digests, making calories more available to us. It makes food so that we can store it for a little bit longer, keeps it from going rancid. If then you take the leap into smoking foods, now you're talking about preserving, right? You pull all the moisture out and you can stick it into, you know, a sack on your hip and carry it around very, very long distances. So We believe that fire and food really started all of that. And to me, that now draws a direct line to modern human health. Because so many of the issues that we see in modern human health are connected in to what we're putting into our bodies, how we're fueling our bodies, and really overfueling, you know, and with the wrong types of foods at this point. So how did we get to where we are today? We had one ancestor who left Africa, who spread out, who moved into these varying environments, seashores and mountaintops and rolling hills and plateaus, the desert and the jungle and the tundra, the Mediterranean zone, you know, and with all of those new challenges came new solutions and came intelligence and came shared knowledge and information. And those individuals gradually moved into what we identify now as basically the Neanderthals, as most people say. And then humans who came in later, about 40,000 years ago, modern humans, and did some mixing with the Neanderthal species that were there, and then ultimately became dominant. And so that was about 40,000 years. That's kind of where we are today.
So 40,000 years ago is when we humans, Homo sapiens sapiens.
Correct.
You said earlier.
Yes.
Kind of a subspecies of Homo sapiens is what we are.
Right.
And that was about 40,000 years ago.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So before then, we have evidence of species who look exactly like us. I don't know if you've heard of Cro-Magnon. You know, some of our listeners may have heard of them. They are identical to us physiologically, but because it's so far back, we can't, you know, definitively say these are Homo sapiens sapiens. So we call the whole family tree, you know, the whole family unit Homo sapiens, and we are what we identify as a subspecies, modern humans.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, and 40,000 years ago, and we were, humans were populating, tell me again, what part of the earth?
They were mostly in North Africa, moving down into South Africa, and then into kind of what we identify now as the Middle East, into Europe, and then into Western Asia and Southeast Asia. So really the Eurasian continent and Africa. The most firm evidence for movement into North America ranges between 25 and 35,000 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. At the most, the farthest limit, that there's a lot of contention there.
Okay, gotcha. All right, and part of what, as a medical doctor and thinking about health and thinking about disease, and then thinking about how we humans developed as we did 40,000 years ago, 20,000, 25,000 years ago, part of what I think about is, of course, what we ate. You know, where we gathered our, where we gained our nutrition from, and our body activity, how that was part of our life back then. And it, you know, and I know we're going to get there later in the talk today, but the bottom line is, in my mind, I'm wondering and thinking about our physiology and our metabolism developed over those thousands of years prior to that 40,000 years ago, and closer to us, that's thousands of years of humans being here, where our physiology of our body and our metabolism of our body got to be a certain way, worked a certain way, evolved in a certain way with the foods and activity that we had then. And then if we look at then, of course, we're going to look later at today, and that we have the same, generally, we have the same building blocks or the same physiology and metabolism-iness, but how can we function like we were made to function over those thousands of years when we were developing if we're not consuming nutritionally the same way as we were back then or active the same way we were then? It just makes sense to me that our health and the workings of our physiology and metabolism will not be correct if we're not, if we don't have the building blocks of our nutrition and activity that our bodies were made for back then. That's what I'm digging. I'm enjoying the hearing how we've developed, and I want to hear more of your thoughts on this subject.
Right. So when we look at the timing, and then we look at the climate, the general climate of the planet. Now, it's hard. You know, we, the terms paleo really, you know.
Yeah, what does paleo mean? What does that mean?
It's complicated. It depends on which author you're reading.
Because there's a paleo diet.
There's a paleo movement. Okay, so what does it mean anthropologically?
Yeah, yeah.
So it means ancestral, pre-industrial, you know, a certain tool type, basically. Very, very simple tool use. So we're talking about before the use of metal, before, you know, smelting metals and the use of metal tools. So basically stone tool, bone tool types of technologies, which are really impressive, by the way. You know, I don't mean to degrade at all, you know, how technologically exciting, you know, they were at the time. But before, you know, real tool fabrication like we know it today in the industrial model. So when we look at that paleo time, as far as anthropology goes, that's what we're talking about. Now, when you apply it to diet and you apply it to today's world, it's hard, and this is where I have trouble. If you talk to anthropologists, you know, they have opinions about these things, of course, because, you know, which area are you talking about? Are you talking Mediterranean, North African, South African, Middle Eastern, European, glacial, tundra? You know, the people who walked through Siberia up over the Bering Land Bridge, they probably weren't eating our modern paleo, you know, style of diet. They didn't have quinoa, you know, in the Bering Land Bridge. So when we look at the way that people ate, they were adapting to those local environments. What we do know about that time period is that the last real ice age that we, you know, we identify, this kind of glacial period, we are still experiencing the end of a glacial period. And most people just think about global warming and heating up, but because we have these polar ice caps still, you know, hanging on by a thread, this is a glacial period still technically. But the end of the real tough glacial period was about 11,000 years ago. And that was this big period of drying. And this is when we had the drying out of that Mediterranean zone, and the middle of Africa got much, much, much more dry. You had the development of those deserts. Movement of the tectonic plates had kind of stabilized. And so this big drying out period, many anthropologists believe, was a selective force. Excuse me, I probably shouldn't be saying. A naturally selective force that chose or selected for those people who could make it through times of famine. So who could really last through these dry periods.
You know, when we talk, that was about 11,000 years ago.
About 11,000 years ago, but it was when that, you know, the end of that really glacial period. So as these glaciers continue retreating north and south, we have a growing of the equatorial dry zones. Right? So, and those zones that are out of the jungles, you know, they're getting much, much drier. So now there are positives and negatives to this. This means that those fruits that grow on trees year-round, you know, my parents' place in Mexico, they've got avocados and mangoes and papayas and all of these wonderful things just dripping off of trees, you know, almost year round. But really, you're talking about hot season, hot and dry, or wet and hot, you know, seasons. We're not talking cold and hot. So when people talk about paleo, this can mean many different things. So if you want to talk paleo and be really accurate, it's really pre-processed foods. You know, and it's before the addition of the processed sugars and the pharmacologic doses of sugars in the majority of our foods and the processed carbohydrates, right? So when we think paleo, you'd basically just think nothing in a package. You know, everything out of a package and everything that is unprocessed for the most part. Yeah, so those people were probably the ones who did the best at survival and then were the ones who got to pass their genes into future generations. That's what natural selection is, right? It's a force that weeds out the ones who can't make it forward. And then it kind of funnels down those who are best adapted to continue to pass their genes on. So as these individuals kind of were adapting, the general belief is that basically those summertime, spring and summer and late summer fruits, right? If we think about what grows right now, my neighbor just called me and said, come get plums, they're falling off the tree. You know, you got plums and apricots and nectarines and peaches, and apples are a bit later. You've got all the berries coming into fruition, right? A lot of the beans and the squash, you know, these are really sugar-rich natural foods. And they also are have a lot of nutrients, right? So we as humans have evolved to crave certain foods or certain flavors, excuse me. And we're talking sweet, which is what I'm talking about right now, fatty and salty. Those are the three, right? And if you think of any of your most favorite foods, I would wager a large sum of money that it has either two or three of those flavors, right? The sweet, the salty, and the fatty. So we craved sweet because that is a carbohydrate. That is a sugar. Our brains run off of glucose alone. That's the power for our brains and much of the energy in the rest of our bodies. We have to consume a certain amount of it in order to just survive and to not fall into a state of lethargy, right? So craving sugar is going to help us to meet those nutrient needs. In addition, ripe fruits have the most nutrients, right? They're going to have the most vitamins in them. They're also going to have the most fiber in them. You know, they're going to be the best for us. So we crave these sweets. But as you know, I don't need to tell you this, sweets also, as we consume sugars, it's going to kick off that insulin, you know, the hormone that's telling your body to store the fat. So a lot of anthropologists and others believe that that summertime bounty of all of the sweets and the sugary foods is a signal to the body to store the fat because we're going to head into those tougher times. So when we think about our ancestors moving around and being what we called hunter-gatherers for a long time, we also call them foragers today to kind of take out the value of hunting over gathering, basically. We call them foragers because the majority of most of these people's calories come from the daily foraging and not the meat, actually. So as they're...
Say that one more time.
With foraging or hunting and gathering, foraging, actually going out and collecting what's available, provides many more calories than does hunting. The only time this isn't true is with like Inuit cultures, you know, people who live in areas where there is no vegetation and really it's
like
hunting.
In Alaska.
Correct. Yeah. In Canada. The Pacific Northwest.
All right. Where they're living on ice and...
Right, and protein and fats are the vast majority of their diets.
Right.
Yeah. So foraging, collecting. So their bodies are going to be consuming lots and lots of fruits, lots of berries, and then another big one is honey. So many, many cultures, and especially in North Africa, into the Congo, Tanzania, they consume massive amounts of honey. And a fun parallel to me is, you know, bears, right before they go into hibernation, they gorge themselves on berries and honey, you know, and then fats also. And so they are triggering that lipogenesis, the storage and the production and then storage of extra fats. So if we think back to our ancestors, the consumption of mass amounts of natural sugars is triggering a storage of fat in their body before we head into that the harvest period and then the time of really meager, you know, food supplies. And if you wanted to go look around Chico, you know, right now we've got farmers market, we've got fruit falling off of trees, we've got, you know, so much abundance. But think about fall, think about October, November, December, January, even into February. What it looks like. Could you go out and forage food?
It dries up.
It dries up, yeah. And everything around us goes into hibernation. The trees and the grasses and the flowers, everything pulls their energy inward for a little while. And I can't help but think that humans do the same. You know, that we kind of pull down and we have things like the gourds that come into fruition. And, you know, we have a lot of, if you look at Chinese medicine, a lot of the orange and red fruits in the wintertime, those are kind of those fiery foods that a lot of the belief is that it actually helps to kind of fire up and keep that metabolism moving and going. And we get a lot of those nutrients in the winter through those colors. So now we compare that evolution and thinking about starvation. And even, you know, a few hundred years ago, we read the traditional Aesop's tales to my son at night. And we did Hansel and Gretel, which is a frightening tale. You know, the father has to go collect nuts in the forest to help to feed his children, to keep them alive. And that just hit me. You know, as parents, any of you who are listening and who are parents, think about not being able to provide for your kids, not just because of money, but because there is no food growing. You know, so to have these extra fat stores, your body first wants to burn carbohydrates. That's those, you know, the starches, and that's the sugars are also carbohydrates. And then it moves to fat
when
it's available, right? And then our bodies switch into fat, and it takes a little more energy to burn the fat. It's a little, you know, more sluggish. The very last thing our bodies want to burn is the protein, you know, because then it's burning up its own muscle tissue. And the byproduct of digesting protein is nitrogen in the bloodstream, ammonia, and then a rise in the pH level, which can actually be really bad for our internal organs. So going back even a couple hundred years, thinking about our bodies going through the cycle, time of plenty, putting on the fats, you know, gaining a little bit of extra insurance for the winter time before we move into this very lean, lean time where you lose all that fat. And then when spring comes again, you know, those first buds and flowers and fruits, we can go through that cycle again.
Mm-hmm.
How often do we as, I'll just go ahead and say modern Americans, mm-hmm. how often do we as an industrialized nation have a long period of time when we have not only an absence of calories, but an absence of sugars?
It just doesn't exist.
It doesn't exist.
Basically.
And the cheapest foods, the most mm-hmm. highly available foods, are loaded with the carbohydrates mm-hmm. and not even sugar anymore. The high fructose corn syrup, which, mm-hmm. as it turns out, is even worse than those processed sugars. So that's how I really connect these in. We have adapted to crave sweet to prepare for that winter, right? Mm-hmm. We crave fat because that's our insurance policy. And we crave salt because sodium is a very rare mineral in nature. Mm. And it's essential for the movement of fluids throughout our bodies. So cleaning out your cells, you know, you need those electrolytes, you know, conducting the nerve impulses in our brains and throughout our bodies. We need sodium. So salt was a craving because it is that important. Mm. We have no shortage of sodium today
mm-hmm.
either. So those three that we've adapted to and evolved to crave and to want and desire was an insurance policy for our ancestors to help
for
them
survival.
To survive. Right. And now we have big companies producing foods that push those buttons, those three buttons, sweet,
salty,
fatty.
They're taking advantage of our, of those buttons we
they
have.
They are that, really smart. Mm-hmm. They are taking advantage of those buttons and they are just pushing them. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, a two-year-old with a remote control for the first time, right?
Mm.
Just, you know, pushing and punching those buttons. And as we crave and consume more, our bodies don't want to turn on the shutoff switch.
Mm-hmm.
It feels good to eat those foods. Mm-hmm. they have these pleasure centers in our brain that are mm-hmm. dedicated to recognizing those flavors. And mm-hmm. my mouth's starting to water just thinking about them, right? You know, when we have salt, we crave sweet. You know, we bounce back and forth and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And as we move around with just massive abundance of these foods, that's where I see the door into the declining health that we're seeing mm-hmm. today. And the sweet, kind of a pun, S-U-I-T-E, of metabolic disorders,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That we're seeing today in modern medicine.
Wow. And I, you know, back again, just to revisit that, you know, thousands, a few thousand years ago, 11,000 or ish, when we as a human being were eating those sweets of the fruits of the time of the year when they were available,
mm-hmm.
and then down the line into the part of the year when we were in drought and not available, we stored the fat from eating carbs and the fat and
right.
Calories as best we could. We put on fat. Then we survived that way through the drought, through the lean part of the year.
Right.
And then now we're where we are now with abundance, really, mm-hmm. all year long. But yet those still those metabolic cravings for those that sugar and that fat, to put on fat, is still with us.
Right. They persist.
And those companies, and the companies that make the food, like you say, are well aware of what turns us on.
Absolutely.
Physiologically and taste-wise, and so they take advantage of that, and the human being today suffers the consequence.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, if our goal is to make money,
right?
You know, then we're ignoring what's best.
Yeah.
And I feel like we're kind of at this precipice, or we're kind of at this, the foot of the crescendo, right? Mm. You know, as a physician, I know you're feeling this, and I know you're seeing this everywhere. And this is where I feel like a lot of us academics and people who work with humans and think about humans a lot, we're all kind of sticking our heads up and looking at each other, you know, and we're seeing these similar trends.
Mm-hmm.
And these threads that are making up the fabric of our lives today, and we're trying to piece them together. And I think that work together and doing this cross kind of, I want to say departmental because I'm in the academic world, but mm-hmm. this work across different fields, mm-hmm. I guess you would say, mm-hmm. is what is going to, you know, get us to the next step in the most healthy way possible. And
mm-hmm.
so many people say, but we're living longer than ever. But we're propped up. you know, by so many medications, and we're, you know, we're extending human life perhaps beyond what we should. And I mean, I want to live until I'm 500 and meet my great, 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 great grandchildren, but I want to be, you know, running around and healthy while I do it. And, you know, so it is an argument. There's an argument the other way. It's kind of like, well, it's 77 degrees in Chico today. What's global warming? You know, I feel like human health, we all need to stand up for ourselves and advocate for ourselves. And I'm raising a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, and a 4-year-old. And it is like a war zone in front of the pantry some days in my house. You know? And knowing everything that I know, I have to make compromises and prepare my kids for the world that they're in today. And that's really
difficult.
And it's
a tough job.
It's a really tough job.
When those things are available, all those foods and the advertising, et cetera, and the other kids are eating this. And it's a tough job as a parent.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Let's take a little break here, okay, Melody?
Great.
And let's listen to a little music. We'll be right back.
Fantastic.
With The Doctor's In. This is Ken Logan and The Doctor's In. I want to remind everybody that towards the end of this show today, we'll be speaking with Dr. Mark Lundberg, the medical director at the Butte County Public Health Department, and he'll give us a health update. But now, for the rest of the show today, we are talking with Melody Yeager, a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at CSU Chico and Butte College. And we're talking about the development of human beings, anthropology, and how that relates to our health.
how we developed the way we are physiologically, metabolically, and how that relates to our health today, partly from a standpoint of disease, but overall health and food intake and body activity. And we're going to hear more from Melody Yeager. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Talk to us some more.
Well, so we talked a little bit about at the break about, you know, how we can how we can talk about today's world, you know, and the foods that are available today and how we relate that to the past. And I think it's foolhardy to not recognize where we've come from, you know.
Absolutely.
And to not think about the past, and even just such a short period of time, you know, 100 years, 150 years, and how different food systems were. It took us millions of years to get to where we are. Mm-hmm. So for us to change our food system so drastically in
so quickly.
Yes. Yeah. In the last 100 years, you know, that's my great grandmother, and without going too far into genetics, you know, mm-hmm. when we talk about epigenetics, and that's another fascinating topic related to food, we have an entire epigenome, and that's the area of our genome that is malleable and that is reacting to the environment. Mm. And if you think about when you were really formed, you know, and we think about our genes, it is your maternal grandmother who, when she was forming the fetus, which is your mother, your mother was forming all of those eggs that she was ever going to have. Mm-hmm. So your possibility of life was really formed inside of your grandmother. Mm-hmm. You know, and so what we are discovering now is that it is the grandparents' generation that is doing a huge contribution to our epigenome. And a big part of that is living through famine, living through times of not having those carbohydrates or those sugars, the glucose that's going to power our brains, mm-hmm. right? So when we think about looking at these studies, we go back two generations. And my grandmother, you know, she was born, gosh, I don't even know. She was born in the 30s. So we're getting up on 100 years, you know, when she was born. And then when she, you know, had my mother was in the 1950s. And, you know, so that if we think about that, what was she eating then? What was mm-hmm. food like back mm-hmm. then? One of my favorite stories my mom tells is she had two siblings, and they would get one chicken. And mm-hmm. a chicken back then was not the chicken that we know it today, mm-hmm. right? It was much smaller. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, 4 to 6 pounds instead of like 8 pounds. Mm-hmm. And they would roast one chicken, and the family served themselves. My grandfather would serve himself first, and then my mother's oldest brother, and then my grandmother, and then my mom's older sister. My mom was the last to serve, and she got what was left, which was oftentimes, you know, the gizzard and the heart and the neck, and they would eat the marrow of the chicken. Mm-hmm. You know, so even my mother's growing up, you know, you ate what was there, and if you were hungry after dinner, sometimes that was a fact of life. Mm-hmm. That is not a fact of life for the vast majority mm-hmm. of Americans. Now, mm-hmm. poverty is an enormous issue. Childhood mm-hmm. hunger is a shameful mm-hmm. Issue in our country. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's 1 in 6 kids goes to mm-hmm. bed in our country hungry or mm-hmm. and wakes up hungry in the morning. Mm-hmm. So that's another issue, obviously. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, all Americans were eating this way, where sometimes you didn't have enough mm-hmm. and that was life. Mm-hmm. And for us now, eating to the point of physical distension and mm-hmm. discomfort is really common for 3 to 5 meals a day, mm-hmm. you know, depending on who you are and, mm-hmm. and what you're eating. So by looking at the past, I think that can help to shape us now. Oh, I'm not going to sell or advocate the paleo or the primal lifestyles necessarily. Mm-hmm. I love that they ask us to look at the past, you mm-hmm. know, and to consider the way that we eat. Mm-hmm. And also that when people were getting food historically and prehistorically, they were moving to get mm-hmm. that food. Mm-hmm. You know, there was body movement associated with the capturing of, the collection of, the cleaning and the processing of, mm-hmm. of foods. So for foragers, hunters and gatherers, for most of the world, early on we're talking about a lot of tubers. especially during those winter months. And tubers are root systems for some plants. You know, if you've got tulips or dahlias, or, you know, those are all tubers too. Don't eat them. But we're talking about things like jicama. You know, that's a tuber. What else? Potatoes and sweet potatoes and yams and all those things. Those are tubers. So every, you know, spring, that little tuber gathers all of its energy and it throws up a big spike and it collects all of this sunlight and it photosynthesizes and it makes sugars. And it sends those sugars down into that tuber and the tuber grows. And, you know, and every year it's going to send up these, but it becomes dormant. And so we go and take advantage of them when they're dormant. But that means digging. You know, and
some activity.
Right. And go out, take a shovel on your own property if you have it. Go dig a hole. It's work. It's labor. Turning soil, you know, it's a lot of labor. So to go and go into a squatting position, you know, where we are moving the body into what is actually quite a natural position for most people, not us Westerners, you know, and digging up these tubers, finding them, a skill of actually finding them, finding burrowing animals that are underground, whether they're lizards or they're some kind of a mammal, you know, that's underground, climbing a tree, you know, collecting honey. That's a perilous job. But in northeastern Africa, the Hadza, who are really highly studied right now, they're one of the last, you know, traditional hunter-gatherer foraging communities on the planet. There are only a handful of them left, truly. There are times of year, you know, in those summer months when they're leading up to winter, when over 70% of their diet comes from honey.
Oh, wow.
Their calorie intake comes from honey. So going and collecting honey, that means climbing a huge tree and braving these bees and knocking down the hive and running. You know, if we think about how we get food, getting up off the couch, walking to the refrigerator.
It's the total opposite.
A little bicep, you know, pull back. Maybe you could consider that some lat work, I guess. You know, opening the fridge, bending over, pulling out the stuff. The reward for us is dense calories and fat. So when we make that comparison, you know, I don't know what you want to do. If you want to set up a track around your house so that you have to earn your food, I don't know. But if we just, again, look to the past, it gives us a lot of answers about our present.
Absolutely.
And so many of us struggle with finding that body composition that is healthy and makes us happy. I'm not going to talk about weight because I think that can be kind of a senseless measure. But it's that composition of the body, you know, that we're looking for, we're striving for, what is healthy for us. A lot of us struggle with that, and that's a lot of it because we're not moving our bodies.
Moving our bodies.
We're sitting. We're part of this sitting culture, you know, and that tells your body, you know, relax, shut down, go into energy saving mode. Right.
And our bodies didn't develop that way.
No.
Our metabolism and our physiology didn't develop with a sedentary human.
Right.
It was an active human.
And when they sat, their body needed that rest.
Yeah, needed because they had worked or been active. Exactly. Wow. So we're really living life. That's the opposite, food-wise, what we need, and activity, the opposite of what we were. Our system was developed to do best with. When we were active and we were eating.
It's very unnatural.
Wow, it's unnatural. That's right. We are living an unnatural way.
Right.
Both activity and the ways we eat, what we eat and how much we eat. Wow. That's a good way of putting it. Wow, so now what do we do? if you were going to try to teach someone how to be relative to the foods in your life, and relative to body activity, how would you advise them relative to thinking back on how we humans developed in the a few thousands of years ago? What should we do?
Well, I think about one of my heroes, Michael Pollan, who you may have heard of. He's out of Berkeley. He's an author. He was, I think he did a lot of investigative journalism to begin with, and then started kind of hitting on the common issues. He was featured in Food, Inc. He wrote a book called Omnivore's Dilemma, which is a great entryway, a very well-written, very humorous entry into learning about the truth of our food system today.
Omnivore's Dilemma.
The Omnivore's Dilemma.
And is it a relatively small book?
It is. It's a nice little chapter book. You can find it used. It's actually the assigned book for my anthropology of food class, and my students love it. It's great to read.
Say the name again.
The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Omnivore's Dilemma
by Michael Pollan.
All right.
Yeah.
Good. And then he's written some later
books,
right?
A lot of books, yeah. He wrote a few before that one called The Botany of Desire, which is a wonderful book. It's a lot of fun. And a bunch of other ones. In Defense of Food is another more recent one. And he's got a special on Netflix right now. I guess I'm plugging him right now. Called Cooked. It's a four-part series. It's really fun.
But say his name again.
Michael Pollan.
P-O-L-L-A-N. All right.
Yeah, so he said...
Sounds like a must-read.
It is. It's on my list. You know, I read it a lot. It's just one of my favorites. So he says, eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Please say that one more time, at least one more time.
Eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
There you go.
And it's just a boiled-down way of saying... I mean, and he loves food. Uh-huh. You know, he's a food lover. You know, he's in Berkeley. He's got access to Alice Waters and Chez Panisse. And, you know, he loves food, but he sees the issues that we have today. So he sees ways of enjoying food still.
Yeah.
But if we go back to, again, those ancestors, and for the vast majority of us, those plants and those plant products were making up an enormous part of our diet.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the paleo and primal foods is cutting out some of even those vegetable foods, you know, legumes and are not really, they're kind of frowned upon, and a lot of the gluten-containing foods are frowned upon. But when we just strip all that stuff away and we just say, eat food, not too much, mostly plants, that is a way to signal your body back into a very healthy way of eating. And again, we closed out the last segment saying it's tough, you know, and any of my friends who are listening who have been to my home and seen my pantry might be screaming hypocrite. We all have to make our... kind of figure things out, and I want to teach my kids how to navigate food today, how to have a little bit of something and just enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, you can have too much of anything.
Yeah.
You truly can.
Absolutely.
You can have too much of anything. So allowing a few things into the diet is, I think, smart, so that kids aren't fully deprived and, you know, see the first pantry of their lives of processed foods and go nuts, not be able to stop. But, you know, the words high fructose corn syrup and trans fats are used very commonly in my kitchen and with my kids. And I just want them to know, if they're going to make choices, to make the smartest choices possible. You know, the least of the evils, I guess you could say.
And just to reiterate what you said, and enjoy food.
Enjoy it.
Within reason on the quantity or amount of certain types of foods, et cetera.
And I mean, maybe we could ask our listeners. I don't know our demographic or anything of our listeners, but my college students today, when I poll them, how many of you could name which foods are in season when? If you think about seasonality, we have erased seasonality with the you know, Safeways and the Raley's and the Costco's, because you can buy strawberries in winter.
Mm-hmm.
They came here on a jet from Brazil or Mexico. You know, they traveled a really long way, but you can get them. They don't taste like much. They probably don't have many nutrients. You can buy them. So people today, and I had to learn about seasons. My mother kept a beautiful garden, and I had to remember when the artichokes grew and when the berries grew and when our apple trees and fig trees, you know, were dripping with fruits.
You had to learn it as
I had
you
to
were
remember
up.
That. Yeah, I learned that growing up, and I had to kind of remind myself of these seasons, because when we go to the grocery store, we can buy anything anytime we want. But to just kind of be aware of those seasons, and to maybe cut back or cut out, you know, processed sugars in the wintertime. Maybe that's a good thing for your body. You're signaling to your body, you know, let's not go into rapid fat storage right now. And our lovely celebrations in the winter between Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's. I mean, those are just sugar bombs, typically,
absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
You know what I think about? I see a lot of patients with diabetes, and I just love to work that into this conversation.
Right.
We're gonna slow down here a little bit. And is that correct?
Yeah, 2 minutes.
Yeah, just to. Just to reiterate the issue of body activity too. I'm just thinking about you know, being here again. Our physiology, the way our bodies were made, and to be the maximum health able, involved some body activity on a regular basis, and. Likewise, the food, like you said, 80 some odd ish percent of our food were plant-based, is mm-hmm. that correct?
Mm-hmm.
As we developed, humans developed.
For most cultures, yeah.
For most cultures, and, yeah, for most cultures. And the quantity was, first of all, there were no processed foods.
Mm-hmm.
And the quantity was much less, because availability was less.
Right.
And it varied depending on the time of year.
Yeah, and walking is a beautiful thing. You know, our bodies, we are so geared just to walk.
We're made for it.
Yeah, and psychologically, you know, so many studies of when you get out and you expand and see the horizon, you know, psychologically, we get these wonderful rewards, you know, on top of the other rewards. And just the balancing of the hormones and the, you know, everything that's happening in our bodies, all those chemicals, walking, you know, people might say, but I can't do CrossFit, you know, and I'm not, you know, it's
Don't then.
Go walk.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go for a walk. Just a little ways. I think that would be
huge. And it eases our stresses.
Absolutely, which contributes to fat storage as well, right?
Yeah.
You know, if we're talking about the stress that's then also causing a lot of fat storage.
You know, I do, you know, I just think, I'm thinking about another show or us doing another show. Because maybe we could, diabetes is a big thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of... it's just a big subject in our world right now, health-wise and complication-wise. And if you're open to it, I would like to bring you back on the show.
I'd love it.
And we'll zero in a little more on diabetes.
Great.
All kinds of diabetes.
Yes.
Okay, that'd be great. That's a great subject.
I enjoy that.
Well, let's see. Now what do we want to say? I want to say thank you very much, Melody Yeager, who is a lecturer in the Department of Anthropology at CSU Chico and Butte College. Thank you so much for being on the show and talking with us about anthropology and the health of the human being.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And now what we'd like to do is talk with Dr. Mark Lundberg. What's your title, Mark?
Dr. Logan, it's so nice to be with you. I'm considered the health officer of Butte County.
I always say the medical director, but the health officer of Butte County.
It's a pleasure to be with you. That was a fantastic guest, Melody Yeager. Wow, that was wonderful. You know, she mentioned Michael Pollan and some of the books that she has her students read that are excellent. I remember he wrote a book called Food Rules, and I believe one of them is don't eat anything more than 5 ingredients. You
right.
look at the label, or ingredients you cannot pronounce.
Right.
Probably a good rule.
It's a great rule. If you don't know what it is, don't put it in your body.
Don't buy food where you buy your gasoline.
Oh, that's a good one.
I think that's another good one. You know, you can't probably find too much quality food where you buy your gasoline.
Right.
So, well, I had a few things that I was going to mention, Dr. Logan, if you might have some time.
Sure, thanks.
You know, in public health, you know, we sometimes bump up against civil liberties when we're talking about good public health policy.
Hmm.
You can think about immunization laws you know, that require children to be immunized to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
That's civil liberties versus a public health policy, or tuberculosis control.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we recently had a new law go in place that I am very, very for, but it's certainly some people could say it's going too far in violating or crunching your civil liberties, and that is the tobacco rule came into place just recently, in the last week, I believe, where you have to be 21 now to buy tobacco.
Oh.
And, you know, with a product like tobacco, I can't think of any rule that I wouldn't be for that can make less tobacco used less. But that is that is one of our dilemmas in public health. But that is one of the new rules went in place.
And is that in California?
In California. That was passed and signed by the governor. Also in California, they passed a law that made e-cigarettes defined as a tobacco product. So wherever a tobacco product has a regulation, e-cigarettes applies as well.
Sounds like a wise idea.
I think these both will benefit the public's health, and I believe they offset the benefit, offsets what civil liberties might be impinged upon. So anyway, that's going into effect.
We've been talking about plant products here, edibles, and the benefits thereof. But that's a plant product right there, tobacco, that is absolutely not a positive. That is a negative plant.
It is a negative plant, is exactly right. I mean, there's nothing to me that'll hurt your health more than sucking in the smoke of that burning plant into your lungs.
As a family practice doctor, and you know this too, Dr. Lundberg, you know, one of the worst things to do is to tell somebody they have, you know, it's a horrible thing for a doctor to have to tell a patient they're dying of lung cancer and there's nothing you can do for them. Or tell them, or watch their bodies get thinner and thinner as they struggle to breathe because they have emphysema from a lifelong smoking. It's a tough thing for doctors too, I will say, as a doctor.
It is exactly right.
Yep.
So that is... you have time for another
yeah,
item there,
sure.
Dr. Logan?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just might mention that, you know, a lot of discussion about opiate addiction out there and a lot about prescription opiates and about the problem we have in our country and in our county. We have a lot of ER visits, a lot of hospitalizations, a lot of deaths due to opiates in Butte County. One of the challenges is that a lot of people get started on opiates by using people's opiates that may be in the medicine cabinets that people have at home.
Mm-hmm.
And proper and safe disposal of medicines is a public health concern. I was very happy to see that Walgreens in Chico added a medicine disposal site to their 24-hour Walgreens. In Butte County, we also have the Orchard Hospital receive any of your medicines, including opiates, and the Feather River Health Center in Paradise will receive any of your medicines for disposal. And these are important. If you have medicines in your cabinets, don't let that be a public health concern to your children and to your grandchildren. You know, remove it, dispose of it properly, and get it out of your house if you don't need it.
And that's that. The 24-hour Walgreens here in Chico will take medicines that need to be disposed of.
Right. They have some kind of a kiosk there in their pharmacy, and you just,
great,
without any questions asked,
right,
you just drop your medicines off there, put it right inside.
Remembering that they should not go into the trash otherwise.
That's right. We really like to avoid it from going,
mm-hmm,
in the trash.
Mm-hmm.
Good advice is to not put it in the trash.
And
there are ways that if you're desperate, there are ways that you'll see that there are some instructions for how to do that, but we'd like to avoid that.
And then you said you gave the advice on the opiates. Say, for instance, somebody in the household does have an opiate prescription, keeping it locked or in a place where other people cannot, in the family or other people around them cannot get that medicine, maybe locked up would
That's
be
right.
good.
If you're using it and you need it, then keep it safe because those medicines are valued by drug addicts, and unfortunately, too many young people get started,
right,
by using someone else's opiates.
Right. Well, Dr. Lundberg, thank you so much again.
All right. Very nice to talk with you, and have a great and healthy day.
Talk to you next month.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks. And thank you, Melody Yeager, again, anthropologist. And thanks to Ray Lager, the engineer for this show. We couldn't do it without him. Remember to keep listening the third Thursday of each month, 6 to 7 in the evening, for the Doctor's Inn. The Doctor's Inn is made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Hearing Aid Center, changing lives through better hearing since 1949. Chico Hearing Aid Center is devoted to providing the best hearing possible with a Try Before You Buy program and state-of-the-art hearing aids. Chico Hearing Aid Center provides hearing evaluations at no cost to determine your benefit for hearing aids. For an appointment, call 342-8132. And by the Banana Grape Stomp, airing Saturdays at 10 p.m. on KIXC-TV Channel 9, featuring live music performances from Northern California. Programs include the Chico Area Music Awards Ceremony with Swamp Zen, Severance Package, Lips of Renegade, Solar Estates and Western Divide. Past episodes available on YouTube. The Banana Grape Stomp, Saturdays at 10 p.m. on KIXE Channel 9. The opinions voiced on this show do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. See you in the third Thursday of each month. Stay tuned for Beatle Nation.
And just a quick announcement that tickets are still available for James McMurtry. Show starts just about now. Max Gomez will be opening the show till about 8 o'clock, and James will take the stage. It's at the end of Normal Street, 2500 Estes Road, free parking. Please do not park on Estes Road. You will be towed. Carpooling and bicycle is encouraged. No pets allowed. Of course, guide dogs and service dogs are always allowed. Kids under 12 free. Bring a blanket, bring a lawn chair. There's food available. See you out there.
To be filled.
I don't need no doctor. I don't need no doctor.
I don't need no doctor, no. Or prescription to be filled.
I don't need no doctor. I don't need no doctor.
All in my baby's arms. A good